Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, New York State's Local Cops Local Crimes Act took effect yesterday, ending formal cooperative agreements between local law enforcement and federal immigration agents. That ends the Orange County Jail's agreement to house ICE detainees, a practice that dates back to 2008. We'll hear how the change will work and what it means for Orange County. Back to school means new teachers, new classes, and increasingly new questions about artificial intelligence. We'll hear what local school leaders are saying about AI in the classroom. Plus, a blood drive this week honoring a longtime Sullivan County volunteer and Red Cross supporter, a new wellness business opening up in Livingston Manor this weekend, and a theater project exploring the early years of the Lebanese Civil War. That's coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Tech giant Meta has reached a settlement with a coalition of states over allegations that Facebook and Instagram harmed young users and misled the public about those risks. The case also accused the company of improperly collecting children's personal data. Under the settlement, Meta will have to pay $17 billion. The agreement was reached during trial in federal court led by the state of California. Stocks on Wall Street opened higher this morning as the Commerce Department reported sticky inflation. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up about 11 points in early trading.
Consumer prices in July were up 3.7% from a year ago, according to the Commerce Department's inflation yardstick, which is closely tracked by the Federal Reserve. That's the same annual rate of price hikes as the month before. Prices rose 0.2% between June and July, and personal spending rose by a similar amount. Personal income rose a little faster during the month, so people were able to sock a little more money away. The personal savings rate rose to 3%, which is the highest it's been since April. The chipmaker NVIDIA is set to report quarterly earnings later today after the market closes. NVIDIA is considered a bellwether of the artificial intelligence boom. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration is preparing to revoke the business and tourism visas of up to 200,000 people who have applied for asylum in the U.S. NPR Sergio Martinez Beltran has more on the new policy.
Tom Pigott, a spokesperson for the State Department, says getting a visa to later seek asylum is fraud. And that's because people applying for a tourist visa have to say why they're coming to the U.S. And the government is arguing that if the person did not tell the immigration officer they were planning on claiming asylum, they have essentially lied. And that's enough to revoke a visa.
NPR Sergio Martinez Beltran. President Trump's Board of Peace is criticizing a recent series of Israeli attacks in Gaza. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports.
The Israeli military has been blowing up Hamas weapons storage facilities in Gaza and carrying out targeted killings of Palestinians accused of taking part in the October 7th, 2023 attacks on Israel. The Board of Peace told Israel it opposes striking weapons depots because it disrupts efforts for Hamas to hand over weapons. The U.S.-backed board also said it objects to Israeli military action in Gaza beyond responding to genuine and imminent threats. That's according to an official with the Board of Peace not authorized to speak publicly. In Jerusalem, Israel has seized a facility run by the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, which Israel has banned from operating in Jerusalem. The move was condemned by the UN's Mideast Peace Coordinator. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
This is NPR News. More than 50 people linked to organized West African cybercrime groups have been arrested in a multinational operation led by Interpol. NPR's Joel Bright reports a total of 22 countries, including the United States, took part in the operation.
Interpol says the operation, codenamed Operation Jackal 4, ran for 8 months and led to the arrest of 58 people across six countries. Those arrested were linked to various cybercrime offenses, and officials say an additional 263 suspects were identified during the operation and are being investigated. Interpol says the operation was launched in response to the escalating global threat posed by West African criminal networks who target victims of all ages, including minors, in mostly English-speaking countries. Last year, the FBI worked with local law enforcement in Nigeria to arrest 22 people who were blackmailing and extorting minors with explicit images of themselves. Some of the victims ended up taking their own lives. Jewel Bright, NPR News, Lagos.
Brazil's data protection agency has fined TikTok parent company ByteDance nearly $30 million over its handling of young users' personal information. Regulators say TikTok collected and processed data from children and teenagers without a valid legal basis or adequate safeguards. ByteDance says the violations cited by regulators date back to 2021 and do not reflect more recent changes to the platform. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Studios with The Dog Stars. Director Ridley Scott returns with a post-apocalyptic thriller starring Jacob Elordi, Josh Brolin, Margaret Qualley, and Guy Pearce in theaters and IMAX August 28th. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. The New York state law that bans formal cooperative agreements between local law enforcement and federal immigration agents took effect yesterday. Governor Kathy Hochul says the Local Cops, Local Crimes Act is essential to establishing community trust at a time of aggressive tactics by federal agents in cities across the country. The Orange County Jail, which, according to the Orange County Sheriff's Office, has housed ICE detainees since 2008, is now banned from doing so. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC's Ilya Skera has more.
The Local Cops, Local Crimes Act, which goes into effect today, bans formal and informal collaboration between local law enforcement agencies and federal immigration enforcement entities. That means Orange County Jail will no longer be able to hold federal civil immigration detainees or Immigration and Customs Enforcement detainees that don't have criminal charges. In a statement, the Orange County Sheriff's Office said it plans to adhere to the new state law, adding, quote, ICE will be responsible for transporting the prisoners. Any questions regarding ICE contracts should be directed to the county's attorney. Orange County legislator Genesis Ramos, who has opposed ICE's presence, previously said about ICE's targeting of immigrants.
This is a tactic that we have seen throughout history. Over and over again, where a specific group of people is othered and targeted and made to be the enemy, the bad person, the group of people that we blame all our problems on.
Neither ICE nor the county attorney's office responded to WAMC's request for comment. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Elias Guerra.
Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar did speak with the Orange County attorney, Richard Golden, Tuesday afternoon about how the termination of Orange County Jail's ICE agreement would work.
So yesterday we sent the required termination letter to the Department of Homeland Security, ICE, terminating the contract.
What does that mean exactly? Will the individuals who are detained at the Orange County Jail, have they been transferred already?
I'm just saying that once the contract is terminated, now it's up to ICE to remove those detainees, and they will be doing so. They don't give us information as to where they're going, so we do not know where they're going. But that responsibility is for ICE and not the Orange County Jail. We're not transferring them to any other facility. Completely up to ICE.
Do you have a sense as to how many individuals are currently at the jail that are being detained by ICE?
I don't, but it's something that is fluid. It always has been fluid, but also they have known about this then impending termination. We advised them a while back after the passage of the new law so that they were aware that this is going to happen, and I believe they started transferring prisoners out a while ago and are continuing with that process.
In terms of long-term planning, so does this mean that the ICE unit at the Orange County Jail is permanently closed moving forward?
Well, the only way that we had the ability to accept ICE detainees was through a contract. That contract is now terminated. So we have no ability to take on new ICE detainees coming in. Under the contract, they had 60 days once the contract was terminated. So they're required to get out everybody within the next 60 days. So starting yesterday.
Gotcha.
Just under the contract, they had 60 days once they were given a termination notice, and we gave them a termination notice as required by state law. We're trying to comply with the law. I believe we have done so fully, and this process will work its way, and the county will no longer have any ICE detainees.
That's Orange County Attorney Richard Golden speaking to our own Kimberly Izar yesterday afternoon. Golden later clarified that ICE has 60 business days to transfer all individuals detained by ICE from the jail since Orange County terminated the contract yesterday. Now, with students heading back to school soon, teachers and parents are preparing for another year of homework, tests, and lessons. But there's a new factor changing the way students learn: artificial intelligence. AI tools like ChatGPT are increasingly part of the educational landscape, raising questions about how students should use them, where schools should draw the line, and how teachers can make sure students are still doing the work of learning themselves. The River Reporter recently spoke with local school superintendents about the upcoming school year. Reporters Sonia Ahmed and Patrick Kelly join us live in the studio now to talk about the challenges and opportunities AI presents. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Your reporting started with conversations with local superintendents about the upcoming school year. What did you hear from school leaders about how AI is changing education locally? Patrick.
I think, what we're hearing right now is just that it's still such an emerging technology that there hasn't been. There's no uniformity yet. It varies from school to school. A lot of times it varies classroom to classroom. Teachers are using AI. There are some tools that have been set up for students to use, but still it's Wild West.
Sonia, you're hearing the same from the folks you spoke to?
Yes. I spoke with the Wallen Popak superintendent in Pennsylvania and also the Eldred superintendent in New York. And especially for the Pennsylvania side, it seems that they're just sort of starting to have these conversations. There is concerns about will students continue to think critically? And in Eldred, the main concern is plagiarism. Will they cite this AI or will it write essays for them? That sort of thing.
How are local schools that you've spoken to approaching AI right now? Are they seeing it as a tool, a challenge, or some combination of both?
Sullivan West, I can speak to. I sat down with Dr. Bresler, the superintendent of Sullivan West, and she said that they are seeing it as a tool. They're not seeing it as something, a foe they need to overcome. It's something that can be used to not replace a student's learning, but add to it. They have a program called Think First, which allows students to write math problems, and then it will work through, the AI program will work through those math problems with the student, not giving them the answers, but giving them alternate solutions or how to solve it. So it's definitely a tool. They are kind of embracing it openly. Students just need to cite or say that they used AI. There isn't that adversarial relationship that you would expect.
Yeah, and same with Eldred as well. They do have one AI program that they're kind of starting to implement. That would be Magic School AI. Ferrero's main thing was that they do need to cite it. So that's the only AI program that students are allowed to use. But for faculty, they can also use Google Gemini. So the way she described it is that she wants students to be prompt engineers, which basically means that they can learn how to ask the AI a question, but not have it necessarily do everything for them. And then on the Pennsylvania side in Wallen Popak, they're starting to have those conversations, but they don't have a specific program that they're implementing yet.
It sounds like educators are seeing or hoping that this is being used for legitimate assistance for students, brainstorming research rather than completing assignments for them. But are they seeing that in students as well, or fearful that that's going to happen as well?
I mean, I'm sure there's going to be the student that comes at this with this is an easy way to write my essay. Oh, this is an easy way to complete this math problem. And I don't have to do any critical thinking at all. But from my conversations, at least, it seems that they were not viewing it as an emergency. They were viewing it more as like, this is the opportunity to increase depth in learning. And if students cheat. I mean, students have been cheating since the beginning of education. So,
are schools finding that the traditional approaches to homework and take home assignments, for instance, are also changing because of AI, or will need to change because of AI?
Yeah. So for Wall and Popak, they're still kind of having those conversations. But I know for Eldred, the main thing is that, again, just cite it, you know, make sure that if you are using it, you're not just like ripping it off and not citing it. The thing is, Magic School AI, it can't write a whole essay for you. From my understanding, you can ask it a question and it'll give you an answer. But the way that Ferrara described it is you need to have specific wording for your question. She described it as garbage in, garbage out. So if you ask it a bad question, it's not going to give you a good answer. So that's what she means by prompt engineers, and that's kind of how they're using it right now.
And how are teachers responding? Have you heard from teachers, or what the superintendents you've spoken to telling you that teachers are saying about AI and how they should handle it in the classroom?
I mean, I know Chilpin West is having this thing called Tech Tuesdays where they have tech instruction for teachers. There recently was a meeting at Sullivan West where one staff member who's also a parent of a student said that the way that Sullivan West was doing it was good, and she really enjoyed it because it allowed her child, who was a student, to kind of break things down more and see alternate solutions to problems. But yeah, I don't know if Elgrove has seen any.
So for Wall and Popak, at least, I know that they're just sort of having these conversations. Teachers are mostly worried about kind of just them not being able to think critically, like just using AI to do everything for them, that sort of thing. That's why they're just having those conversations. They don't have a policy in place. But the whole thought is that Wall and Popak does want to kind of find a way to do it in the sense where it wouldn't just be students, you know.
I will add also on a more organizational level, we have seen teachers' unions speak out a lot against AI. They are afraid that it could eventually replace teachers, and they are calling on Pennsylvania and New York to regulate usage for the benefit of teachers, but also for the benefit of students. We've seen that AI chatbot usage has had negative mental health effects on young people, and it's something that we should be actively looking at.
And did you hear any concerns from superintendents or educators that were talking about how it raises accuracy and misinformation questions and students becoming overly dependent on AI? But did you hear any folks saying that it could potentially help when teachers have like limited time and resources to help individualized help with students?
I mean, that's really the guiding principle behind ThinkFirst and why Sullivan West decided to adapt it. They said that when you get into higher level math classes, the teachers are not going to be able to help as much. They are not college trained. They're not PhDs in calculus or astrophysics. So when you get to questions that might need a little bit more of an advanced understanding of this math, that's when the AI can step in and kind of help with individualized instruction.
Yeah, same for Eldred. The way teachers are using Google Gemini there is to help them create lesson plans, create those kind of test sort of things. It can help them when they're kind of in a time crunch, and that's kind of like the leading force there as well, it seems, is that teachers are the main ones kind of using it and helping out with their teaching duties.
That's Sonia Ahmed and Patrick Kelly from The River Reporter. They've spoken to local school superintendents about the rise of AI in the area and how it is changing the way students learn and teachers teach. That reporting is in the current issue of The River Reporter, riverreporter.com. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
And the rise in artificial intelligence is creating a growing demand for massive data centers. Next, we'll learn more about the ones that are proposed, 24 in the Pocono Mountains. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills. From inpatient and outpatient care to primary, urgent, and specialty care with Garnet Health doctors in Sullivan County. Exceptional lives here. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
Hello, Radio Catskill listeners. This is Andy Carlson, and I'm inviting you to join me Thursday nights for 2 hours of genre-bending exploration of the American rock songbook on Ramble Tamble. I'll be bringing you everything from John Prine to PJ Harvey, Steely Dan to Steppenwolf, and just about everything in between. That's Ramble Tamble, Thursday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The rapid expansion of artificial intelligence is creating a growing demand for massive data centers, but communities across Pennsylvania are questioning where those facilities should be built and what they could mean for residents. In the Pocono Mountains, approximately 24 projects have been proposed near forests, waterways, tourist destinations, and other environmentally sensitive areas. Radio Catskills' Patricia Rubio spoke with Emil Lounsbury, a reporter with Inside Climate News, the nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization covering climate, energy, and the environment, about residents who are worried that the developments could permanently change their landscape, but supporters are pointing to the potential tax revenue and economic benefits.
Before we get into the story, could you sort of introduce yourself and tell us about your background and the kind of reporting you do for Inside Climate News?
Sure. I've been doing stories for Inside Climate News for about the last 2 years. My background is I was a reporter for many years on staff at the Philadelphia Inquirer, where I wrote mostly about corruption investigations, covered courts, examined problems in the justice system, wrongful convictions, and that kind of thing. And then I became a professor of journalism at the College of New Jersey. So fast forward, I was really missing the reporting that I used to do. And so one of my former colleagues at the Inquirer, Vernon Loeb, now is the executive editor at Inside Climate News. So we sort of reconnected. And this is somewhat of a new area for me, considering that I spent most of my time in and around the courtrooms. But it's very interesting to me.
I guess you're using your investigative skills and those type of things you did in the past, I guess, to look into environmental stories.
Yeah, it's very exciting. There's such a need for this kind of reporting, and I'm all in with it.
That's great. Emily, for your latest article, you want to sort of give us an overview of what is being proposed across the Pocono Mountains, and how extensive is this all new development happening?
Sure. So actually, this story began as a look at exceptional value streams and wetlands in Pennsylvania. And this is where the state gives kind of a gold star for streams and wetlands that are extremely high quality and very pristine. And it turns out that 80% of those streams and wetlands are in the Poconos. So I started to look at the Poconos and noticed that, hey, a lot of data centers are proposed there, and some of them are in or near these exceptional value streams. So that's kind of how the story began, and then it evolved to include not just environmentally sensitive areas, but also tourism areas. So generally, what I found was that there were roughly 24 proposed data centers up there. That's a very fluid number because some are more formal than others, you know, and some just start out with a landowner coming in and saying, hey, I think I have a piece of land that might be suited for a data center. What can you do about the zoning here? So things are very fluid, and I think if there's one undercurrent throughout all of this is that it's very, very a fluid and ever-changing situation.
And one thing I always wondered about, like you mentioned, like folks have a piece of land that might be suitable for what they think might be suitable for a data center. But, you know, the Poconos, much like where we live here in Sullivan County in the rural Catskills, the Poconos are known for their forests, their waterways, and, you know, outdoor recreation that's, you know, brings in a lot of money into not only the towns, but also the state. Why are data centers targeting these particular regions?
That was actually my big question. And as I looked into this, I thought, why would you risk the blowback from residents and potential court challenges? Why would you go into such an environmentally sensitive area? And it turns out that the Poconos really has not just what, you know, people who love the outdoors and an open environment want, but it turns out that it's also a good place for data center developers because there's a lot of open land and water and there's a lot of good power sources in that region.
And it seems like, you know, these things, folks who are concerned about it are on both sides of the aisle a lot of times. And you spoke with residents who live near some of these proposed sites. What are some of the concerns? What are they most concerned about?
Okay. And yes, I think you really touching on something that's really interesting. At a time when our nation is so incredibly polarized, people are uniting over data centers. It doesn't matter if they're Republican or Democrats. There's just a lot of across-the-board opposition to these. And so there is concern. There's concern about, you know, the use of power, and also what's going to happen to the water supply. Also, what's going to happen to their property values? And maybe first and foremost, what is going to change about this environmentally rich area?
And, you know, like one of the things that I hear a lot is about the large amounts of electricity, or in some cases, a large amount of water that's used for cooling. Did your reporting reveal anything about the potential demand on local resources?
Well, that's actually one of the big concerns. A lot of the developers are saying that it would be closed loop water supply, so it wouldn't be, you know, there would not be a humongous demand for water. But I think we're still learning exactly what is going to happen here. So there is a lot of concern about the impact on the water supply. And also, everyone cares about their utility bills. What's going to happen to my electric bill? That kind of thing. So there's just wide opposition and fear about the impact of data centers if they actually do come, if they do get built.
And much of these fights I'm noticing are happening between township supervisors and the local zoning boards. You know, what authority do these entities have to approve these or restrict or reject these projects?
In Pennsylvania, owners of land have a lot of, as you would expect, a lot of freedom to control what goes on that land, as long as it's a lawful purpose. And in Pennsylvania, the law is pretty clear that you just can't say, no, we're not going to allow data centers or anything else, as long as it's a legitimate land use. So there's a lot of back and forth about how townships are trying not to be exclusionary and accommodate the landowner rights or the developer rights to build versus how it will change and impact their communities. For example, some of these data centers have been proposed in areas that are zoned rural residential. So since you can't outright exclude data centers, you have to find a way to allow them somewhere in your township, or, you know, if there's a group of townships within that group. It's not like supervisors can just decide, no, we can't. I mean, you could decide that, but then you're putting your township at great legal risk for a court action.
And one of the things that came up in a recent meeting I attended is not about data centers, but is a proposed, one of the largest solar, I guess, arrays in our county that's potentially coming to two towns in our county, and a large battery storage center. Was, you know, the landowners, you know, how they could financially benefit from these projects and want to benefit from this project. And I'm just wondering, how is that influencing local support for data centers?
Well, if I understand your question correctly, I mean, there is an upside of data centers, and it's a considerable upside. You know, it would help facilitate artificial intelligence in Pennsylvania and beyond. There will be construction jobs for sure. It may well increase tax revenue for these townships. So there's definitely a plus on this. And so it becomes a balancing act of, if you're in a place like the Poconos where tourism is their primary industry, you need your tax base. The money's got to come from somewhere. And if you don't have a lot of other industry, then potentially data centers could provide some very much needed tax revenue.
Yeah. And your article was published before Governor Josh Shapiro signed his new executive order on data centers. What does that order change, and do residents, as far as you know, believe it goes far enough?
I think it's still a little bit unclear. It's the shifting, part of the shifting sands that I had mentioned earlier. So the governor is stepping back and is being very careful, recognizing the concerns of community people out there. So I think it's a little bit too soon to really know exactly how things will play out. It's very much, it's been kind of this gold rush mentality with developers trying to scarf up land wherever they can if it looks like it would could be appropriate for data centers. And Pennsylvania has 67 counties, and there's an awful lot of open space. I think it's going to take a little bit more time before we really see where things are headed.
Now, after you've done this reporting from these communities that are maybe inspecting or may have potential data centers come into the area, you know, what do you think our listeners should watch out as these projects sort of move through the approval process?
First of all, we have to see, like, what projects are super serious. And in some places, construction has already begun. And, you know, in some places, there's very initial court skirmishes that are happening. But I do think that it's going to take some time to sort these things out. So right now, things are playing out mostly at the municipal level, where developers are going to townships and saying, hey, can you accommodate me somewhere? I'm looking at this land, or I've bought this land. Can you kind of do some zoning overlay so that I can build it there? And supervisors are taking a very close look. And zoning boards are also already involved in the supervision of this as well. So it's still early from a regulatory point of view. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how things play out.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Emily, before we leave, is there anything else we have not touched on you want folks to know?
You know, one of my interviews that I thought really helped was with Dan Esty from Yale. And he was striking a cautionary note. I thought he was really good because he did focus on the benefits of data centers on the, you know, the macro level, and yet cautioning that, you know, we have to figure out how to put these in places that is going to recognize the concerns of the communities, and also figuring out how to come up with their own power, and preferably clean energy rather than fossil fuel power. So how the power is going to be supplied is going to be also very interesting.
We were talking to Emily Lonsberry, a reporter with Inside Climate News. Her article, Coming to Some of the Pennsylvania's Most Picturesque Places, Data Centers, examines the growing fight over proposed data center development in the Pocono Mountains. Emily, thank you so much for speaking with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate the time.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Robayo for Radio Catskill.
And coming up, a chance to give blood and honor a man who spent much of his life giving back to others. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey, folks, I'm Alzo Slade from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It's the NPR News Quiz where we make fun of the news and chat with funny people like Hasan Minhaj.
Your parents were not up for you being a comic.
Yeah, they weren't really into it, but that's because they loved me.
Make your parents proud by staying up to date on the news with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
It's Radio Catskill. As we've reported, the national blood shortage that began earlier in the year has now become a blood crisis, meaning there's a critical depletion in blood supply across the country. The American Red Cross is asking for donors of all blood types. A blood drive in memory of longtime Sullivan County community volunteer Al Funzi Frangipani is set for Friday at Garnet Health Medical Center Catskills in Harris. Frangipani was a veteran, a former New York Supreme Court administrator, and longtime blood donor who also volunteered with the Red Cross. He and his wife Maria responded to Ground Zero following the September 11th attacks. I spoke with his daughter, Denise Frangipani, about his legacy of service that still makes her emotional. I just want to start out by asking you about Al and
oh,
what he meant to you in the community.
Oh. It happens all the time. Okay. Okay, so Al, my dad, was a tremendous volunteer when he retired, and I don't remember the actual year it was, but he immediately got involved in the community. You know, here's a guy who was from Brooklyn. He did things in Brooklyn too. He did a lot of fundraising for Kings County Children's Hospital. I remember that. And he was always like a Santa's helper during the holiday season. He would go through the neighborhood in Brooklyn, you know, doing the Christmas thing for people, which he continued to do up here. So he was always everybody's favorite Santa.
And he was a longtime blood donor and he Red Cross volunteer.
Yes, yes.
Why was donating blood such an important part of his life?
So he was so being a blood donor started long before he actually was a Red Cross volunteer. It's because he had a very sought after blood type. He had a clotting factor, which is very rare and needed in the blood bank. So he would often, he was on a list. Sometimes he would get calls if there was an emergency, and he donated regularly. I mean, it was like just part of his routine up until, I don't really remember when he stopped donating, but I just remember him always being an advocate of the blood drive. So, and then he became a Red Cross volunteer. He was a disaster response volunteer. He always loved to tell the stories of the flood. Well, he didn't love the floods, but he always told the stories of the floods in the manor. And he was there and he met Senator Hillary Clinton. And, you know, he would talk about all the people he met along the way and all the local folks who he appreciated.
He and Maria also volunteered with the Red Cross following the September 11th attacks.
Yes.
What did that experience mean to
him? Oh, gosh. So I remember them getting on the bus because it was a Red Cross bus. I think it left from the government center, maybe in Monticello. And I just remember meeting the bus there to be like, be careful. What are you doing? To my parents. But they went down and, you know, it was like anyone else during that time. They did whatever needed to be done. And my mom wrote a beautiful memoir about it that my dad used to take and share with people all the time, especially around September 11th. And, you know, it was everything from just consoling the volunteers, because it was such a traumatic volunteer experience, you know, the hope that you would be helping people, but the reality that, you know, the hope was not right there. But of course, during that time, there was a lot of call for blood. And as we know, we are an incredibly responsive community, Sullivan County, in so many ways. And when there's a crisis, people do rally. But sometimes we don't know that the in-between time is as critical, and the blood banks have to stay stocked. You know, toward the end of my dad's life, he was a recipient of blood because he had a blood issue, so he would have to have transfusions regularly. So it kind of came full circle for him. So there are people like him who need blood, aside from when there are emergencies and disasters.
But there are also people not like him in the sense that all the other things that he did that I want to be sure we mention as well. He volunteered his time at the Lions Club and the St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital.
Yes.
What do you think motivated him to give so much of his time and energy to others?
Well, he loved people, and he always, he would just respond to the ask. That was just who he was. And then once he responded, he would be, okay, what else can I do in this situation? He was very passionate about certainly the Lions Club, especially the sight and hearing. You know, I don't know if you know the Lions Club, they do a lot of eye screenings with children. And he had so many stories about children who were able to be screened and be able to have their eyesight assisted at a younger age. And of course, St. Jude, he is on a first name basis with Marlo Thomas, their buddies. They used to talk on the phone regularly in advance of the, you know, Bold Gold does a big St. Jude Thunder 102 Country Cares for Kids St. Jude Radiothon. There we go.
Yeah.
So he was a very big part of that. And we just did a golf outing last week up at Roscoe Mountain Club, which was an annual event that my dad, Al, had organized with Bold Gold on behalf of or in support of the Lions Club and St. Jude Children's Research. So we did that last week, and it was really great. It was a beautiful day.
the blood drive is being held at Garnet Health on Friday.
Yeah.
I want to get the details for everybody, but also just want to ask what inspired the family to organize this blood drive in his memory?
Oh, Jody Goodman, who my dad met at the hospital, and when he and she recruited him as a patient advocate at the hospital. So that was one of his first volunteer gigs in the community here. So shout out to Jody there. And so Jody asked if we would be okay with, of course, what if I said no, my dad would be very upset. So our dad, I should say, there were three of us. So Jody reached out and asked if it would be all right to organize it. So it will be at Garnet Medical Catskills on Friday, this coming Friday, the 28th, from 9 to 3. There is, you can go to redcross.org and find a blood drive near you. So just type in the zip code for Monticello, I guess, 12701, and it will pop up. And then you can select your time. And I suppose they'll also accept walk-ins. So don't feel shy if you can't get on there. Just pop in. It's in the Garnet Health 66 Harris Bushville Road.
It's the one in Harris, not the one in Calicoon.
Exactly. Thank you.
What do you think it would mean to your family if this blood drive has a strong turnout and helps carry on Al's legacy of service?
Oh, I think Al would be very happy. I think he would, if he were here, he would be working the phones, calling people. I'm not as good as you, Dad. He would be calling people and telling them, you need to come. So I think it's just a way to, you know, carry it forward and his at this particular time. But we do there. I know the Rotary just did one last week as well. So blood drives are really important.
Especially now. It's a crisis.
Yeah. So it's if you can do it in someone's honor, it's doubling down for the experience. And of course, our family would be grateful. And this is a Red Cross blood drive. So the Red Cross, I'm sure, would be grateful too.
And I know that Al is grateful and proud of all the kids in the family and all the work that you're doing. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
And we should note that Garnet Health is a financial supporter of Radio Catskill. Next, we'll hear from theater maker and storyteller Rawa El Chab about her new work at NACL. This is Radio Catskill.
Magic the Gathering is a popular card game and also an important social outlet for many of its players.
Once a community is known to be welcoming to queer and trans folks, it attracts more queer and trans folks, and that's a lot of what's happened with Magic.
I'm Elsa Chang. How Magic the Gathering became a source of joy for the transgender community on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen to All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. What happens when history refuses to stay in the past? That's one of the questions explored in Immortal, Rise and Fall of the Jarmak Battalion, a new theater project by New York City-based performer and storyteller Rawa El Chab. The solo performance looks at the early years of the Lebanese Civil War through oral testimony, archival material, and sound. El Chab is developing the work through a residency at NACL in Highland Lake. Audiences will get to look at excerpts from the performance this Saturday night, followed by soup and conversation with the artists. Rawa El Chab joins us live in studio, along with collaborating artist Jesse Friedman. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, Rawa, for those who may not be familiar with the Lebanese Civil War, give us some background and what first led you to the story of the Jarmak Battalion and the early years of this war.
So, the Lebanese Civil War began in 1975, but there was also a period of abolition before it. But what happened was, in 1991, political figures met and decided that now they were going to forget about everything that happened before, which led a large number of artists to begin and think about this erasure and try to reconstruct the history that was erased by these political figures. Actually, all of us study in school and our history book stops at what was happening in 1960. So after that, we have no idea. Students do not study. We don't have a common mythology or a common history that creates our nation. So each one of us tries to complete what's missing from their own perspective.
And you've described Immortal as an excavation. Is that what you mean by that? That you've had to just extract and find all of that information and develop this piece?
Absolutely. What I also noticed after some time of looking into the work of other artists and the work that was coming out was that, it was also taking the point of view of mostly well-known figures. And I felt like growing up with my family, which was very involved in the struggle, I wanted that these stories take the foreground. And I also work as somebody who teaches theater. So I often look into giving these tools to young people to complete these parts of history that I believe are not in their own history books.
What are some of the challenges of telling a story like this through individual memories and testimonies?
Memory is always a tricky thing. And it's something that we have to come to terms with when we're working on this kind of project. There's also the fact that sometimes you're digging into these back rooms and you might discover something that you were not expecting. Because as people tell stories, they kind of adopt a narrative. And if you go digging into these narratives, you're going to find out that, the facts don't necessarily add up. So this is something that you have to admit and accept as you're looking into these archives and these stories.
Jesse, I mentioned you're a collaborating artist here. Talk a little bit about some of those challenges that you experience through your involvement in this piece, and then also navigating this tension between preserving historical memory and allowing for some interpretation.
Sure. I come to this project as a director and as a dramaturg, and often when I work as a director, I'll have a text in front of me that I'm pointing the collaborating team to look at. And in this iteration, where we are in our process right now is the text is Ralia and the stories that she tells. So yeah, I've done a little bit of research into this like very, very deep history, which I really only have a drop in the ocean of that story. So I really look and point everyone towards Ralia and to the stories that she's telling and kind of cobbling together and piecing together a picture from what's coming out of her mouth. And then what she tells kind of off the cuff, the story that's kind of coming together in her brain becomes what we all kind of gather around.
And I want to talk about not only the what's coming out of your mouth, but what's on the set, the visual aspect of this storytelling. You researched plant life in southern Lebanon. It's become part of the set. What can plants and landscapes and the natural world tell us about conflict that traditional historical records might not?
So this is what I've been noticing lately, because I was visiting Lebanon this past summer. And I wanted to bring this a little bit further in the work, because lately we've been noticing that wild animals are coming closer to human beings because they're kind of suffering from all the bombardment and the destruction that's happening in their habitat. We're also noticing the disappearance of certain flowers and certain herbs. So these are the losses that we end up, that occur due to our, you know, continuous involvement in these struggles. And these are stories that also deserve to be told, as they are also being erased. There are animals and flowers that are being erased who live with us.
Your work also has been shaped by your experience working in refugee camps. How has that experience influenced the way you approach stories about conflict, survival, displacement?
So I worked a lot in refugee camps, and often working with young children, I began to notice a tendency. Some of them dreamt of an end. So often I would ask them, what do you want to become when you grow up? And some of them would tell me, I want to become a martyr. Mm. And this is the first question that got me to look into all this. What is making these young people, this new generation, these kids who should be running around and playing, want to become martyrs? So this is what is instigated the trilogy from the beginning, is trying to understand this idea, this of martyrdom that actually comes from that is very anchored in the monotheistic religions.
What have you been discovering as you've been workshopping the piece at NACL this week? And again, the presentation of these selected scenes will be Saturday. What have you been discovering about it?
So I work with a bunch of amazing artists and designers, and they have been participating throughout the work to every step of it, to be honest. Lately, I came back with a conflicting idea. Because I have always been relying on these archives as a source to strengthen my position, and we've been using them in the design, we've been using them in the storytelling. And lately, during my last visit to Lebanon, I noticed that kind of hunger for the archive that turned it into a sort of vulturing. And this is a conflict that I bringing to my team today, and it is putting us in a very interesting position because we are relying on something to give us ground, and here I am in the last installment of this trilogy questioning that same ground on which we've been walking. So it is a very it is interesting. It's a good thing to be questioning these grounds as an artist, but for the moment, I am in the storm.
Folks, we'll get to see the selected scenes of Immortal Rise and Fall of the Jarmak Battalion Saturday at NACL in Highland Lake. That's Rawa El-Chab and Jesse Friedman, collaborating artists on the piece. Thank you both for being here, and there's more information at nacl.org.
Thank you.
Coming up next, a new wellness center opening in Livingston Manor. We'll meet the founder of HeartSpace. This is Radio Catskill.
Wherever you go, take Radio Catskill with you. Stream your favorite shows, music, and podcasts anytime, anywhere with our new and improved app. Stay connected with local news and national headlines all in one place. You can even send us your thoughts with the Talk to Us feature, audio or video, right from your phone. No radio? No problem. Just press play. It's Radio Catskill right in your pocket. Download the app today on iPhone or Android.
It's Radio Catskill. A new wellness space is opening in Livingston Manor this weekend. Heart Space, founded by acupuncturist and longtime movement teacher Sophia Hartnell, bringing together yoga, Pilates, breathwork, and other practices. Hartel says she wants the studio to be more than a place for classes and hopes it can become a gathering place where people can slow down, reconnect with themselves, and build community. Sophia joins us now. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Tim.
And you
That's right.
Yeah, you've described HeartSpace as a place where small-town life and ancient practice can meet. What does that vision look like in practice for you?
Well, we would love to have classes every day for all ages, children and elderly, and a variety of classes available for people to come and move and breathe and just connect.
I mentioned you worked as
I mentioned you worked as an
acupuncturist for more than 25 years. You've also spent the 14 years working in a drug treatment setting. What have you learned from that work about trauma and healing in the nervous system?
Oh, so much. It's been such an incredible honor and opportunity to be working in this field. I work at Mountainside Treatment Center, and I see how important it is for people to be able to slow down and breathe and just start to really feel what's going on in their bodies. And they're able to do that with acupuncture and yoga and breathing exercises that, you know, just the clinical work is important, but we really need these other practices to help them, like, feel better.
Yeah, connect, reconnect with their bodies. Why is it important for you to create a physical gathering space like Heart Space rather than simply offering, you know, classes or individual treatments?
Well, I would love for, you know, I just love meeting the people in the community so we can come together and support each other. It's a different energy than just doing classes online or, you know, it's important for us to have that actual physical connection.
And you use the word sangha, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, which can refer to a community of practitioners. What kind of community are you hoping to build?
Well, everybody's welcome. People that just want to come and learn and grow and heal and share their own medicine with each other.
And starting a new business can be a leap of faith. What's the process of opening HeartSpace been like for you so far?
Well, we're HeartSpace Catskills. If you want to go online and see the website, we've been open for 2 months now at HeartSpace Catskills. It's been incredibly awesome to meet so many new people, the students walking through the door and getting the teachers that would like to be a part of it together. And it's been pretty challenging. You know, we had a flood in Livingston Manor a few weeks ago, and we lost our air conditioning system. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of a setback. But it's also just been really energizing and awesome.
And your official grand opening is this Saturday, 3, at HeartSpace Catskills. What do you hope the space becomes for the community, not only in the Manor, but the surrounding Catskills community?
I hope it's a thriving place where people can come and really grow and learn and you know, expand our love and awareness and, you know, caring for one another.
All right. Well, that's Sophia Hartel, the founder of HeartSpace, was born from her longing for a place where small town life and ancient practice can meet. The grand opening Saturday. More information at heartspacecatskills.com. Sophia, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you so much. Hope you can come down and join us.
All right. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Catskill. A reminder to download our new and improved mobile app. It's available for Android or iPhone. You can get it wherever you get your apps. And stay connected with Radio Catskill wherever you go with the latest local news, local talk, the podcasts, all the shows, the music, right there in the palm of your hand. Download the new and improved mobile app free wherever you get your apps. I'm Tim Bruno. That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at tavernonmainny.com.
News comes fast, and it doesn't take weekends off. But we can slow it down a little, take a moment to think, look behind the headlines, and even have some time left over for surprises and a little fun. Join us on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Sunday mornings at 8 on Radio Catskill. No radio? No problem. The Radio Catskill app has you covered. Hear conversations, music, and NPR live, no radio required, and stay up on the latest local news whenever you need it. Download the Radio Catskill app today.
Today's weather, sunny and nice, a high of 77. Increasing clouds tonight with a low of 57. Some thunderstorms could be heavy tomorrow afternoon through late tomorrow night. Looks like a high of 74 Thursday and a high of 78 for Friday. Pleasant and nice on Saturday with a high expected near 76 and less humid. On Point is coming up next. It's 11 o'clock.
WJFF Jeffersonville. Streaming online at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.